Hi, everyone, and welcome to the OLR Podcast, Episode 8. My name is Jenna, and I am a senior editor and the online manager of podcasts with the Ottawa Law Review. This episode marks the beginning of a new format for the OLR Podcast, where we hope to interview authors who have published articles with the Ottawa Law Review. Today, I will be speaking with Dan Priel about his article titled, That Is Not How the Common Law Works, Paths to Tort Liability for Harassment, which was published in Volume 52, Issue 1 of the Ottawa Law Review. Just a reminder, the OLR is an open access journal, and this article is accessible on the OLR website. So if you have not already done so, you can access the article there. Dan Priel is a law professor at Osgoode Hall Law School. He has received degrees from Hebrew University in Jerusalem, the University of Oxford, and Yale. Dan Priel has been published extensively in the areas of tort law and legal theory. Dan Priel's article is a fascinating look at the possibility of creating a tort of harassment. Dan critiques the Ontario Court of Appeal decision, Merrifield versus Canada, where the court found that there is no tort of harassment in Ontario. Later in the article, Dan outlines that without creating a new tort, there are several possible pathways to liability for harassment that could exist within the current structure of the common law. Now, on to the interview with Dan Priel. Okay. Hi, Dan. It's so nice to see you again. We're just going to dive right into it, if that's okay with you.
Hi, Jenna, and hi to the listeners. Yes, let's go ahead.
Awesome. So my first question for you is, why did you decide to write this article? What kind of inspired it?
So, you know, I teach tort law fairly regularly, both a basic first year, first semester course and an advanced torts upper year course. And I, while teaching, I think the advanced torts course, the decision came out. And I don't remember exactly, maybe someone sent it to me and I read it. And I just did not particularly like it. I neither liked the reasoning at the level of tort law, the tort law analysis, but also the more jurisprudential view taken about the role of common law courts. And I thought, okay, maybe I could say something about this. So most of my work on tort law or private law is more of the private law theory, so it's more discussing the work of other scholars. But I thought, I actually do know something about legal doctrine. And so maybe for once I could write for an audience that's larger than the 50 or so private law theorists around the world, and maybe have something to say about the law. And so I did.
Cool. That's great. We're glad you did. So would you be able to provide like a quick summary of the Merrifield decision and what they kind of said about the tort of harassment, just for people that might not know?
Sure. Yes. So Peter Merrifield was an RCMP officer from 2005 to 2014. And this is actually beyond this, things start getting contested because you get a very different picture or story when you're reading the Superior Court decision and the Ontario Court of Appeal decision. But it is not contested that he had some altercations with his superiors. He claims that they harassed him and bullied him constantly. They reply that he was insubordinate in all kinds of ways. So, for example, the Ontario Court of Appeal decision points out that he ran for office while on the job without complying with RCMP regulations, that he made media appearances describing himself as a terrorist consultant, again, without saying that he was a government employee, essentially, and that he even misused his corporate credit card. So now I should say I don't get into any of this in my analysis. So I don't take sides on this. Maybe he his facts, his claims were not meritorious. But so anyway, so he ultimately filed a lawsuit on multiple grounds, saying that he was bullied. The Superior Court dismisses almost all of his claims, but allows his action on the ground of the tort of harassment. And so in the course of doing so, Superior Court has to say there is a tort of harassment in Ontario. And Crown appeals, and a large chunk of their appeal and their Ontario Court of Appeal decision is disputing the facts. And so here, the Court of Appeal just seems to have a different story about what had transpired. And as I said, I don't take sides on this issue. But the court also says there is no tort of harassment in Ontario. It's never been recognized. And there is no reason or point or need for recognizing one. And even if there were such a need, we, the Court of Appeal, are not, we don't have the legal capacity to do so. That would exceed our powers. And so that's sort of the short summary. And I focus on those legal questions.
Right. And so I know you touched on this in your article, but why do you think it's important to have a recognized tort of harassment?
Quite simply, there's extensive empirical evidence on just how prevalent harassment is. And it happens everywhere, but most commonly it happens in the workplace, where I should say there is some legal redress through sexual harassment, but not all harassment or workplace harassment, but workplace harassment has to fall under certain recognized categories, and not all harassment fits this. Another place where harassment takes place is schools. And the third place where harassment takes place is, of course, the internet and social media. And the latter in particular is where it's extremely prevalent. And currently with no clear legal redress, although when we may get to this, there is a subsequent decision of the Ontario Court, Superior Court, that may have provided, have done some work in that direction. So it's as simple as that. There is just overwhelming evidence about the prevalence of harassment.
Thank you. And I'm curious on your take on the judicial development of the common law. I really enjoyed this section of your article. So if you could just touch on, like, how do the courts decide when they want to potentially develop the common law versus just coming to a decision and not, you know, maybe making that change as we saw in Merrifield?
So, you know, that's one of the big questions of the common law, and it's, so those areas of law known as sort of common law subjects, contract, tort, to a lesser extent criminal law, because nowadays it is based on statute, but these areas of law have been developed historically almost exclusively by judges, right? There is no tort code in Canada or in other common law jurisdictions. The question of the limits of judicial power is sort of embedded in the very idea of law that is created by judges. And if you go back to the 19th century, it looks like judges then were did not feel that they had to kind of engage in deep discussion on the limits of their power. And many times they created new torts without announcing it with great fanfare. So there is the tort of inducing breach of contract that was created in one case, Lumley versus Guy, and without the judges kind of engaging with this kind of question. Or, and closer to our topic, there's the case of Wilkinson versus Downtown, which created the tort that's variously known as intentional infliction of mental injury or intentional infliction of mental suffering. It's a trial court decision. It's roughly 3.5 pages. And the court just says, yes, this kind of behavior is unacceptable, and so it should be a tort. So historically, judges do not seem to have had that much of trouble to create new torts. But you might still say, okay, that was then, and we now live in what has been called by law professor and former judge in the U.S., Guido Calabresi, the age of statutes. And in the age of statutes, so when most of the lawmaking is done by legislation, maybe courts should be a bit more circumspect about creating new torts. And actually, I don't mind this view. And I do think that judges should be aware of their limitations. And limitations both mean their political limitations, that they are unelected officials, but also their epistemic limitations, what they know. Creating new law has all kinds of consequences, and judges are not always in a great position to know what those consequences will be. So I'm not one of those who says, oh, when a judge sees something they consider wrong, they should just run ahead and create a new tort or respond to it. I am aware and I accept that they have certain institutional limitations to them. So my attitude, and that's also how I framed my article, was not to say, look at the terrible outcome. Judges are there to do justice, and therefore they should have reached the other outcome. And so that's exactly why I try to say, okay, I accept, at least for the sake of argument, you, the judges, the Merrifield Court of Appeals position that there are institutional limitations on the lawmaking powers of judges. Having said that, it doesn't mean that judges cannot develop the law. They do it constantly. In fact, the Ontario Court of Appeal, not that long ago, recognized a new tort, the tort of intrusion upon seclusion, which is one sub-element of what may be called the umbrella of privacy torts. And interestingly enough, one of the reasons the Court of Appeal in that earlier decision called Jones v. Seagate, I think that's how you pronounce that the name, but so let's just go with Jones. So in the Jones case, the Court of Appeal, one of the reasons it said there should be a new tort of intrusion upon seclusion is the fact that reality calls for redress, that it's such a common problem. And so I say, well, that's the empirical evidence suggests that that's true of harassment as well. I'll just say one more point on the sort of the more philosophical level. So in my paper, I say in debates about judicial activism versus judicial restraint, the dangerous position is always seen, judicial activism is always seen as the dangerous position. So judicial activism may have all kinds of unintended consequences and may exceed the legitimacy of judicial power and all that. And again, I'm not disputing this. And against this, judicial restraint looks like the sort of the sober view and one that does not raise any questions of legitimacy. And I say that may be a mistake. So even if you think it doesn't mean that if judicial activism raises all kinds of questions, that judicial restraint does not raise similar questions. And that if you want, there may be too much of it. And I give an analogy, which is not perfect, but may be helpful. I say, just like driving too fast is dangerous and causes problems, driving too slowly can also cause some problems. And maybe overall, driving too fast is more dangerous than driving too slowly, but it's a mistake to think that driving too slowly creates no problems. So excessive restraint by courts may be a problem, especially given that it seems like in the balancing of powers between the legislature and the judiciary, the legislature does give some leeway to the courts in those common law areas. It kind of, there is a sort of tacit understanding that, okay, this is your domain, tort law is your area. So it doesn't mean that courts never intervene or never enact anything in this area. But if there is a tacit understanding that tort law is the domain of courts and courts then don't do anything, then their excessive restraint may cause a problem.
Okay, thank you. That was so interesting. Do you want to move on to the Kaplan case now or quickly discuss Kaplan a little bit?
Sure. So the Kaplan case is a case that was decided, I think the decision came out more or less in the same month that my mm-hmm. paper was published. So as a result, I did not make any reference to it in my paper. And the court does not mention my paper, not that it may not have wanted to or known about it, but anyway, so it sort of came out at the same time. And I think the first time I learned about the facts was actually in a long New York Times article entitled "A Vast Web of Vengeance." And it's leaving aside the legal aspect of this story, it's just a fascinating story to read. So if anyone is interested in this area, I recommend reading this this article. There's, I think, even an audio recording, so you can listen to it while running or something like that. So the basic story is a woman who used to work in a real estate agency and was fired sometime in the 1990s. And then held a grudge for a very long time, and then started basically posting highly defamatory statements on her former employer, and then extended it to his family. And so she posted it on these sort of complaint websites that allow people to publish whatever they want with no fact checking whatsoever. And she did this enough that if you Google these individuals' names, her remarks or her comments were often in the top, kind of in the first page of the Google results. And so the plaintiff by then was living in the UK, but he had part of his family in Canada, and the defendant, Aetis, is, or at least at the time of the report, living in Toronto. And so it became sort of this international lawsuit. And so they hired lawyers. And then the defendant started publishing defamatory material on the lawyers of the plaintiff. So, and she did this from public library computers. So it couldn't be easily traced to a particular IP address. So they sue, and the Superior Court issues a decision. And it comes out after the Mayorfield decision. So the Kaplan Court, Superior Court, is bound by the Mayorfield decision. And it finds an interesting leeway, which I think maybe somewhat jurisprudentially suspect, but I'm quite pleased with the outcome. So the court says, okay, so there is no general tort of harassment in Ontario, but we can recognize a tort of internet harassment. Now, you might think that the Mayorfield decision kind of covered the whole field of harassment, and therefore sort of a fortiori, there shouldn't be a tort of internet harassment, but the court seemed to have said or limited the Mayorfield decision to sort of offline harassment and distinguished the case and reached the conclusion that there should be or there is a tort of internet harassment in Ontario. It's not a very strong precedent, obviously, because it's a Superior Court decision. It's but it's there. And sort of time. So as I said, I did not mention this case in my article, but in terms of sort of common law analysis or common law thinking, I found that decision more convincing. And in fact, the court in the Aetas decision does quote from the earlier Jones decision on privacy, this line about this is an issue that calls for judicial change or for judicial intervention. So it does recognize that harassment is a serious problem. In fact, it does mention the empirical evidence about the prevalence of harassment and says we need to do something about it.
Okay. And I'm curious then, the outcome of Kaplan, do you think this will create a patchwork for there to be creations of torts for different kinds of harassment instead of there just being one general one?
So that's interesting. It's possible. So I should say, in a way, there is already something like this, right? Because as I said, in the workplace, there is protection against certain forms of harassment, right? So harassment based on sex or religion or ethnic origin and so on is already, if it happens in the workplace, is protected. It's not it's under human rights codes. So there is that. And there's other ways in which various forms of harassment may be already legally protected. So now it looks like we have internet harassment. The next step may be for a court, maybe the Ontario Court of Appeal revisiting the decision, maybe at some point the Supreme Court, just generalizing the different the patchwork and saying, okay, it's time to generalize it to a single tort. And of course, one other possibility is that legislatures will step in and say, okay, it looks like courts are not stepping up or not feeling that they have the power to do so. So we will do so. And in fact, in some contexts, it already begins to happen. So for example, what's known as internet, as revenge porn, which is a form of harassment in one way or another, is already protected by legislation in certain provinces. Right. So it does look like a kind of patchwork development is occurring. And maybe at some point, either a court or legislature will say, okay, let's try to generalize it. And again, I just add that in some jurisdictions, there are statutes that deal with protection against harassment in a more generalized way.
Okay, so it remains to be seen. This will be exciting to follow.
Yes, I think so.
Just going back to your article, you noted numerous pathways to tort liability for harassment, and you landed on two possibilities as being the most promising, which were updating IIMS, which is intentional infliction of mental suffering, and the other one being incorporating harassment within the tort of negligence. So since writing your article, do you still believe that these are the most promising pathways?
So yes and no. So yes, I definitely still believe in these two. But since then, I've thought of another one. And so I'll say something about the third one. So the first two are IIMS, again, intentional infliction of mental suffering or intentional infliction of mental injury, was born in as I mentioned, in an 1897 English case. The facts are actually fairly simple. We have an individual who tells a woman that her husband had been injured in an accident. This was not true, but she suffered a mental injury as a result. Nervous shock in the terminology of late 19th century law. And she sued. And she won. And so... I said, with fairly modest adjustment, you can create a tort of harassment out of that tort. And so when you kind of go and start looking at the particular elements of IIMS, you see that you have the building blocks for a tort of harassment. The main, what I consider to be the main difference between the two is that IIMS historically is focused on single events, on discrete events. So if you take even the Wilkinson case, the one I just mentioned, so it's someone who comes in a particular moment, tells a story, and there is a sort of immediate result afterwards. And there are similar cases, there's early cases similar to that of sort of practical jokes or pranks in Canada as well. So most of those cases have this form. Harassment sometimes happens as a result of a single event, but I think in the popular imagination, but also in the law, harassment oftentimes deals with sort of ongoing incidents. So when you have constant bullying, constant comments, and so on. And so here I say, actually, it's not that big of a change of taking IIMS and saying, let's just extend it from discrete one-time events to these ongoing bullying campaigns. And I say that actually we see that kind of change to have happened in the rest of tort law. So if historically tort law did deal with sort of these one-time events, and you can see why. When evidence, scientific evidence about how injury happens was sort of in its infancy, it was difficult to draw a causal connection between ongoing events and certain negative outcome afterwards. But even forget mental injury for a moment, just look at physical injury. So if historically tort law looked at physical injury at discrete events and limited itself to discrete events, we now recognize, and there's no issue with suing in tort for ongoing exposure to carcinogens, for example. Right? So no one says, oh, the fact that the cancer was the result of lengthy exposure to a certain pollutant is a problem for suing in tort. So I say, so the idea itself is recognized. So let's just take the tort of IIMS and plug in or add this idea that's already recognized in other parts of tort law, and you kind of got harassment. You can keep the name IIMS if you want to, or you can just rename IIMS as harassment, making the one-time event as sort of a special case of harassment, right? So it includes both the one-time event when it's extreme and the ongoing harassment as another form. So that's one. Negligence is sort of almost obvious. Negligence has not everyone is happy about this, but negligence sort of took over the law of torts because it's proven so flexible in adjusting itself or expanding to deal with areas and questions and problems that 100 years ago, 150 years ago, no one would have thought they could be used. So in some respects, it's sort of... Let's do that too, in this context, and once again, it doesn't require massive innovation here. So if you say an employer, for example, may be liable in negligence for not maintaining a safe workplace, then it's not a significant change to say, well, a safe workplace may involve safe in the context from harassment. In fact, in Ontario now, that kind of harassment is now covered by workers' compensation. So that's a recent development. So again, once again, if you're saying about the patchwork of solutions, so in Ontario, in the workplace, now it looks like there is some kind of solution outside of tort law for this kind of behavior. So negligence seems to fit as well. So I definitely still believe those solutions. But since writing the article, and I'm kind of surprised with myself that it didn't occur to me while writing the article, but I thought of another way of doing it. And I wrote another article, which is not published yet, but well, I hope we'll get published soon enough. And there I say, let's think about harassment as a kind of nuisance. So I do talk about nuisance in the Ottawa Law Review article, but in a different way from the one I'm going to mention now. So here the thought is something like this. So I say, okay, so when it comes to protecting individuals' interests in land, we have two kinds of protection. So we have the protection against direct intrusion, and we call it trespass to land. So if I own a piece of property and someone walks into it, they commit the tort of trespass. And it's quite simple. It's kind of binary. If you're off the property, you're not committing the tort. And if you're on the property, you are committing the tort. But we also have a different kind of protection, which is nuisance. And that's protection against intrusions that are not so direct. So if I own a piece of land and someone plays music very loudly in the middle of the night, they're not entering into my property, but they're using their property or from their property or playing music that interferes with my ability to enjoy my property. So, and that's called nuisance. And now when we move to the domain of individuals' interests in their person, in their body, and in their personhood, I say, so we have the equivalent of trespass to land. It's called actually trespass to the person, and it's the torts of battery and assault and false imprisonment. And especially the tort of battery is kind of similar to trespass to the person. So it's enough that you cross the physical boundaries of someone's person by touching them, if they're not agreeing to you touching them, that you commit the tort of trespass to the person, of battery. And then I say, okay, so if we kind of look at this way, so what is the tort equivalent of nuisance? And I say, well, there isn't one. And I then say, well, maybe we can think of something like nuisance to the person. And I say, well, what is nuisance to the person? What might be a good word to call a nuisance to the person? Well, harassment sounds like a pretty good word for that. But beyond the words, so if we think of someone who is sort of never touching you, but constantly intruding into your selfhood in such a way that prevents you from having the kind of peace of mind that we need for well-being, which is a rough equivalent for what, on certain understandings, is exactly what nuisance is, then that's harassment. And you can call this nuisance to the person. So in a way, again, I'm trying to say we don't need to invent something from scratch. We don't need to say, we should just have a brand new thing called harassment. I say, actually, if you look at what's already in the law, you can build on the tort of nuisance and go from there and say, okay, if we have nuisance to land, let's have nuisance to the person. So that's where I'm sort of, I went beyond the Ottawa Law Review paper.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Hopefully we see that article being published soon. That's so exciting.
It's not in my hands anymore. I'll just say this.
Okay. So this is a little, I guess, unrelated to just harassment, but I'm really curious on just your thoughts on this in general. Are there any other torts that you think should exist in Canada off the top of your head? Can you think of others?
So one area which is developing is privacy. So that's clearly a case where, there is, as I mentioned before, there's the Jones decision, which recognized the tort of intrusion upon seclusion. But privacy has various other aspects to it. And so that's where you may want to see some development. I'll give one example. So in the common law, and that's, by the way, not the view of all jurisdictions, if you publish something true about someone, it cannot be defamation. No matter how bad a light it puts them in, it cannot be defamation if you publish something new about someone. In at least some non-common law jurisdictions, publishing something true may still be defamation if there's no public interest in publishing it. So let's say that I know some dark secret about you, and it's not that I snooped or read your personal diary, you told it to me in secret, and then I go and publish it. So in common law, defamation law, that cannot be defamation because it's if it's assuming it's true. In some jurisdiction, it can still be defamation if there's no public interest in publishing it. So the way that the common law may plug in this hole, if you think it should be plugged in, some people might say it shouldn't, is through privacy, of revealing private information. And so that's where there might be a place for development. And notice that, so that's different from intrusion upon seclusion, right? Because intrusion upon seclusion is when I kind of snoop into your bedroom or snoop into your, you know, hack your computer. This version of privacy involves something that you told me in private and I make public. So that may be a place where there may be some room for development. Of course, this raises free speech concerns. So some may say, no, actually, if it's true, we want people to be able to publish it, even if it's bad for put some people in bad light. So there is the debate to be had, but that's a place where I think the debate at least should exist. So there is still room for new torts to develop. So
for sure. Yeah. Okay. No, thank you. I was so curious on your thoughts on that. Okay, Dan, that is all the questions that I have for you today. Do you have any concluding thoughts for the listeners? Anything you want to say before we conclude?
So I will say one thing.
Sure.
So Ottawa Law Review, like many law journals nowadays, are open access. And I think that's great because the fact that the article is online and basically anyone can download it and read it means that it can be accessed by lawyers and others. And I got a few emails from practitioners who said, oh, I came across your article and I found it helpful and so on. So I think that's great that your law journal is open access, and now we're having this podcast because it for me it was nice to see that that what I wrote was not just written for other academics, but that some practitioners said, okay, that I could actually use it. So I guess congrats to you, and maybe this podcast will make a few other people find out about this, and if they find it helpful, this paper, then great.
For sure. Yeah, we hope so. That's the goal, right? Okay, so thank you so much, Dan, for taking the time to meet with me today and to discuss your article. Everyone at the Ottawa Law Review is so appreciative. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Jenna, and thanks for the Ottawa Law Review team that did such a great job with editing the paper. So thanks.
This concludes this episode of the OLR Podcast. I would like to thank our guest, Dan Preel, for speaking with me today. Also, thank you to the OLR Podcast Committee for preparing questions for this episode and for editing and transcribing this episode in both English and French. Lastly, thank you all for listening.